I think from spending so much time throughout life, like I really haven't looked at the moon, because when you're in prison, whether you're in a kid's prison or adult prison, you actually don't see the moon or the stars for that matter. You don't see the sky. Like, well, sometimes you see the sky. If you've got a window, you can look out, but it's not, you don't go to a, well, I never went to a window to look out. That, do you know what I mean? Because that actually couldn't cause a whole heap of collapse for your mental health, in a sense, about looking outside and thinking about freedom. So I never looked outside. So, yeah, I never took much notice of the moon as such. And I think looking at the moon is such a middle upper class thing to do. Because if you're growing up poor and struggling, you're not lying around the backyard dreaming looking at a moon. There's really no dream, because you're not allowed to dream, because you're told you'll never be what you want to be, which is the dream, right? So, you know, like as a kid, you know, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a doctor. Nah, you won't be any of them, so don't worry about it. So the moon is about, for me, dreaming, freedom, all those types of things, where really it hasn't been a significant feature in most of my life. My mother always said I was the home devil, out of home angel. So apparently, like, I was one of those children that always asked the question why I would drive adults totally up the wall, because we lived in a very poor area, and back in them days the Catholic school would take us as a charity, the poor kids, to go there for free. Parents didn't have to pay. And so the nuns, and they were nuns in them days in their full habits. I remember very early on in the piece, I think it was a grade one, I was little, but I mean, there was this massive tree, you know, like these massive trees here, that are great big old trees that have been there for hundreds of years. The boys are all climbing up and jumping and swinging. And so I got in the tree and I'm jumping around. The nun pulled me out of the tree and said, girls aren't allowed to climb trees. And I got six of the best of the leather strap. And it's like, oh my God. So straight away, what I did in response to go at her was pull her veil off, because I knew that you can't see the hair, and she's running down the school veranda screaming and crying. It's like, well, fuck you, you gave me the strap for climbing a goddamn tree. So I did, why can boys climb trees and girls can't? So I learned that lesson very early on in the piece about the injustices, particularly in that case of being a girl. I think it's probably just in my DNA in that sense. Very strong line of women. Near my grandmother, I was pretty much raised by my grandmother, who's a very strong matriarch. And, you know, she was in Boggle Road prison when she was 17 for being unwedded and pregnant. So, yeah, so, you know, a lot of strong women who resisted in many ways, in ways that they could in that era of their lives, you know. So she would have been, she was born in 1919. So she died when she was 93. So she had a great influence in my life. Mum didn't. Mum tried to be the calm one and not be seen, not speak out. And I was totally opposite to Mum. I think that's why Mum was just, like, freaked out that I was, you know, I was an extrovert, I was out there, I would say what's on my mind, I didn't care. I would call out adults in their inconsistency, still do today. But being a child, and then being a child in a kid's prison, that you become a target very quickly. Because the adults then, the only way they would deal with that was through violence, instead of fixing up their inconsistency or their lies because of their contradictions, whether it was in their behaviour or verbally. I'd never experienced any physical, sexual, any harm at home from my parents or my family, ever. And then when I get locked up in the kids' prison, that's where I experience state violence. So that's how I become very aware very quickly in my being about state violence, not one-on-one violence. That sort of came later, because it comes after being in prison and then you end up in, you know, relationships that are violent. But very acutely aware of state violence, because I'd never experienced it as a child. Other than nuns giving you six of the best for whatever, or throwing the ruler at you and things like that. But it wasn't harm that impacted on me where I was traumatised, right? But the state violence was very, very different, by the cops, the prison, yeah, and all their actors in between. For me, it was about many, many years of state violence in all its forms. and getting to the point that the violence was so bad, you know, where, you know, my friend was murdered sitting beside me, or, you know, a woman calling out for help when she's pregnant and they don't come, and so she gives birth in the toilet, and then they take the fetus out of the toilet, the screws, and snap it in half and put it in plastic bags and throw it between mum's legs. There, that state violence is what stayed and continues to stay with me, and more state violence continues. So just been an inquest recently with Celessa, who was killed, you know, in Towns Women's Prison, in handcuffs, spit-hooded, in respiratory distress. You know, the constant state violence, that's what maintains, for me, the rage that's in me. I wouldn't say it's a fire burning. A fire burning is about something that's seen as a positive thing, like I have a fire burning and I'm following my passion. This is about, maybe I do have a fire internally, actually, and I just want to burn every fucking thing down. So, yeah, it's like so. Because I see the state for what it is. And even just being in places where people are saying, even today in a meeting, you know, we got to fix the system. And I'm going, no, the system is fucked. It doesn't work. We actually need to get rid of the system and build what we need within what is called now transformative. You know, transformative justice is the new language. But I mean, you know, transformative justice is things that we did 50 years ago when I was a 13-year-old kid in kids' prisons. We figured out ways to do things differently that we could be safe in those prisons. You know, now they call it transformative justice. But I mean, the system is the problem, and you cannot fix the system, and you cannot replace it, because that's the other thing. People say, what do you replace it with? It's like, well, no, you don't. Because if you're talking about replacing something, you're actually putting the system as it is in the at the core of the conversation, what you replace it with, right? Like mirror. It's like, no, just remove, dismantle, collapse, burn down, and start again. And not just one thing, you know, like Mariam Carver says, it's, you know, 1 million experiments. It could be 10 million experiments for different communities around the world. We all need to build communities where we're safe, where we have safety and security, and not rely on all these carceral systems, cops, courts, prisons. Because cops come up, this myth or this belief in our communities that cops will make us safe, so the more cops we have, the safer we are, is an absolute lie. Absolute lie. And I don't even know how people get caught up thinking that it's the reality. Cops come after the fact. We've got to deal with harm before it happens, stop it happening. And if it happens, how do we make the individual, in this case, accountable? You know, accountable in the context of relationships, not accountable to a state that picks and chooses who's being held accountable. Genocide has occurred, and it's ongoing genocide of Aboriginal and Torres Strait people, you know, First Peoples of this land, and it has continued on. It's never stopped. And racial capitalism is a framework that's used around the world to be the answer for everything, but it's not the answer. It ensures that a very small number of people are super rich, but there's also a huge number of people that are very, very poor, where wealth in the world could be distributed equitably and everyone would have their needs met, and not this divide of the haves and have-nots. But this is what, you know, because of racial capitalism, what they use is, like, for example, employment strategies. We build prisons, we will employ people. But you need people in prison for them to be employed. So it's this vicious cycle of, whether you call it the prison industrial complex, the welfare industrial complex, the military industrial complex, you know, we pipeline into the military, all forms of military, very poor, predominantly men, usually black men, because their bodies are used where they can be killed and they're dispensable. You know, if people have a conflict, no matter who they are, then go sort out your conflict. Don't send thousands of people in to be murdered to resolve a conflict about who's got the more power. Because that's what the basis of conflict is about, power, right? And control. So it's all intertwined. It's all where you've got to have disposable bodies. And in this country, it's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander bodies, particularly women and girls, you know, and there's a hierarchy of who's disposable. And then you've got people of colour, poor people, you know, and the list goes on. And then, and it's like a pyramid. It comes, you know, those at the top are a very small number, where the bottom, that are where the genocide is ongoing, is quite huge. And but we have then people that are caught up in it, that believe that if we reform things, that it will assist people who are fundamentally, you know, being targeted and dying in the colony. So racial capitalism is the fundamental core of the problem of everything, because it's based in violence, right? And all these systems that have been built out of it, you know, for me, about, you know, cops, courts and cages, are all about violence, racial gendered violence. Aboriginal women are being disappeared and murdered, and not even, cops don't give a shit, they don't investigate, families never know what's happened to them, you know, and the list goes on. And until that is acknowledged, even, like, the state won't even acknowledge that, you know. Like, there's been arguments about, that, you know, saying you can't say that it's racial gender violence of policing that's the cause of disappearance or killings of Aboriginal women. So, yeah, I can. And people get really upset about that, because they have an interest, right, a hook in of the system, how it is, and they benefit from that. And if they don't want to give that up or give any part of their being up, we're always going to be stuck. Because what racial capitalism has done is turned us into individuals, where we only care about ourselves or those that are closest to us. We can't even take the blinkers off to see our neighbours, you know, like John Howard, you know, as Prime Minister, he created policies that allowed racial capitalism to flourish by home ownership for individuals, and then to put the fear of them, like, you need to go to work to protect your home. And then we saw all these bars on windows, closed communities, you know, to keep you safe, when we all know that the majority of violence happens in our own homes. It actually doesn't happen out on the street, the stranger danger, where the fear is put in to us by media and governments, you know, politicians. The highest rate of violence happens in our own homes. And that's where it's got to be addressed and called out. And sometimes that happens, but it's a rarity. If you're living in the top end of town here, where all the old money is, or where rich people are, violence still happens there. They may be able to get things addressed a bit better, but, I mean, you know, you're poor, struggling, you're black, your cops aren't coming. Well, they don't even call cops. We know cops don't come, so you just don't call cops. But, and if you do, then there's that other layer of racial gender violence of policing. So more recently, you know, an Aboriginal woman who has been in prison, you know, experienced horrific violence. Anyway, you know, never goes near the cops, knows the cops are violent, all those things. But it got to the point that I actually need some form of protection. I can't get it anywhere else. So I go to get a DV order, right? Like, as, anyway, sure enough, you go to the police station. As soon as her criminal history come up in the computer system, she was deemed then the perpetrator, because she has a criminal history and she's Aboriginal. And they go speak to the perpetrator, and then they put a DV order out against her, the Aboriginal woman with the criminal history, and she's at high risk now going back to prison. So why would you ever go to the police? Like, that, there's no protection there. Oh, it just takes our bodies and our souls, really. You know, those of us, it literally will take your body and soul. It will kill you. And that's the reality, because you're a disposable body. Aboriginal bodies, black bodies, that you are disposable, and that's the reality. And it puzzles me, and, like, to think that people can't even see that. Like, when it's blatantly in front of you and people are so blinkered, I don't know if they don't want to see it, don't connect the dots. I think education system fundamentally fails us as for children and adults. You know, we're taught what to think, not how to think, which is an issue. So there's a number of things. It's not just one thing, you know. And it, like I said, it's about the rules. of racial capitalism and the rules of patriarchy. Him, her, you know, that's it. Door shut, you know. That's why I think it's really good that this younger generation is really pushing out those boundaries. Now, I see it around me and with the women. I don't think it goes far enough because we have those other systems that are, you know, part of the problem, education system, you know. You've got to toe the line and be told who you are. You can't be who you are. You're told who you are and you're constrained to those labels, to those beings. And if you step out of that, then you're, you know, sanctioned, forced out, pushed out, suspended, expelled, ostracised, bullied, violated, harmed, and we've seen children, you know, get to their wits' end where they can't take it anymore and are killed by their own hands. Well, for me, it's about community. It's about building relationships where, you know, there's accountability, transparency, but also love and care. And when I use that language, I'm not talking about religious shit at all, right? I'm not coming from a religious framework. It's actually fundamentally loving and caring that people are also human beings like me, and we all deserve to be on this earth together in a way where we build relationships that are fulfilling us all in whatever we want to be or how we want to be and what we want to do that's not harmful to others. So that's about the relational connection and those conversations, even the hard conversations, the conflict. That's what relationships are. Relationships aren't all this, you know, love, care, yay, happy. It's about doing the hard yards as well. Because when you have conflict with others in the context of community, you can actually understand the other person on a whole other deeper level in that relationship to move forward, and them as well to understand, to be challenged. We're not here just to be guided and accept of how the world is. We're here to question and ask and feel uncomfortable about where we are. I think that's the problem, right, with racial capitalism. It's like those who are rich can afford to sit back and be comfortable and not feel uncomfortable. When they do, they get really upset about it and they're screaming from the rafters. But, I mean, those of us that are, you know, been in prison, in my context, you know, we know what it's like. So, you know, even when we were kids, like I said, we were practicing transformative justice long before the language of transformative justice. We never had that language. We didn't have the language of abolition either, but that's what we were doing. Transformative justice is about if I see one of the other girls getting dragged by the screws and thrown into isolation and they're left distressed, depressed, screaming, sobbing, crying, it's about reaching out. How can we get you out, keep you safe, do it us girls together? Or if the screw comes back for you again, we all stand together and say no. So it's many different ways of caring for each other, that she's not harmed, but also we're all not harmed, and that we are together. We aren't each other's enemy, the divide and conquer, which is part of racial capitalism. It's about we are together, they are the enemy. The state is the enemy. So let's focus on the enemy and not rip each other apart, because that's classic what happens. Not in violent relationships, but definitely state violence is the divide and conquer. And it's you know, highlighted to the points of extreme inside the prison, how they set women against women. You know, so, you know, when as an adult prison, we actually, as I said, we called meetings with the GM, calling the GM out about what we weren't and weren't getting, where we stood together and not ripped each other apart and build those relationships. And those relationships from when I was in prison then are still relationships of women that are on System Side Management Committee decades later, because those relationships are real. Yes, it's been ups and downs and round like any relationship, and you grow and, you know, you get pissed off and you laugh, you cry, you know, you fight, you know. They're fulfilling relationships. Yes, at times they're very hard to be in the darkest spot together, you know, the deepest, darkest hole, but you also know that the other women are there and they're going to be stand by you to get you out of that when you can get yourself out of that as an individual of whatever's happening. So it's about real, honest, raw relationships. You know, I would just hate to see transformative justice used in a way, and it will get bastardised like everything else. The state takes it on, or others take it on in carceral NGO settings and label, take the name, but actually practice in the same carceral way. That's really harmful. So, yeah, that's why I laugh about transformative justice in the sense because, you know, the younger generation are all using that language. And I do, whenever I use it, it's for a specific purpose. You know, I was using it today at a meeting trying to get them to understand about what's a carceral response as to what's not. And even then, you know, there was women there who work in the sector going, oh, yeah, I agree with Debbie, we need to transform the system. I said, no, that's not what I'm saying. So what I'm saying is we don't want the system. We don't want to transform it. We don't want a duplicate. We don't even want a part of it. It's about building in our communities our own transformative justice model of safety and security that comes from the ground of those communities, not the community members that have the power now. It's about everyone's equal and how we do it. Yes, there's power imbalances, but it's identifying that, naming that, and being clear about, because there's not any like formal power, there's also individual power. You know, like I know I'm someone that holds a lot of power just with my personality, right? And so I'm very aware of that. But I also know I also have power in my role, and, you know, and I'm clear about that. So, you know, like I always say to women when I go in the prison, you know, and they'll go, oh, Debbie, you know, I can love you, I trust you, I want to tell you. I say, no, don't trust me, you don't know me. You might know of me, you know, says, but we need to build a relationship because you don't know if you can trust me. So let's just slow it down instead of launching ourselves into that. Where other people will go, oh, yeah, let's go. And it's like, no. We absolutely need to build a relationship and understanding between us about what we're going to do together, whatever that is, in whatever context that is. And that's also about building safety within the relationship, not only for me, but for her and for other women, because relationships are the things that bring safety. Sure, they can bring harm too, but it's about we'd be more clear about the harm, what's coming, to be able to articulate it. Because we don't actually teach our children to articulate harm or understand harm or deal with conflict because they're sent to, you know, if someone mucks around at kindergarten, they're sent to the head of the preschool, the kindergarten. If someone, child mucks around at school, they're sent to the principal. No one's sitting down with children doing any form of, you know, for worse or worse, conflict resolution to be able to have communication and talk things out. We don't have language to say stop harm because we don't understand it in a sense that can be simplistically communicated. Harm something that's sort of out there that I don't think people necessarily have thought about a definition. And when I say out there, it's because no one's talking about harm in the household. You know, we have clear conversations with, I have clear conversations with the granny about, you know, if they're upset or that something's not right, what's happening? What's happened? Has someone done something to you? Has somebody touched you? Has someone told you not to tell Nana what's happening? You tell Nana anything. Whatever, I don't care what it is. What it is, and if you're worried that you're going to get in trouble, it doesn't matter. I'd rather you tell me the truth and we can deal with it. And so it's about having those lines of communication. Like it's really basic 101, but, you know, we've made these things so complicated by sending children to some adult with power that's how everyone responds now, that we can't take responsibility ourselves or be held accountable ourselves for any form of harm. And they mirror that, and generations. Like after my friend was murdered sitting beside me, you know, the spotlight hit the prison. And people were shocked. It made international news because headlines, because people, one, didn't even know women were in prison. And two, like for a woman in prison to kill another woman in prison was just gobsmacking, right? People were like, wah! But out of that, what happened was all the management level of the prison were sacked. New management came. There was, the DG at the time set up these committees. It's a period that I call reform in hindsight. Most of us women are there, all come through the kids' prison, all been homeless on the street and end up in the adult prison, right? Still happens today. There was, you know, medical visits, a whole of these committees where we could have a say. And so, you know, that taught me even more about how to think around corners, because then I could figure out what their answer was going to be and then figure out the argument to keep moving forward. But and then out of that, when I was went to the low security prison, I said to the women, I'll be back. And the screws are like, yeah, you'll be back. So no, look, you fucking think I'm going to be back. And because I fundamentally believe all we have in this world too is our word, right? We're born with nothing, we die with nothing at the end of the day. Sure, you might have things around you, property or things, but that's, you know, I always say, and on my deathbed, you know, I want my family and friends around me. I definitely won't be thinking, damn, I should have bought a new fucking car or something, right? You don't, because that's what possessions are. They only have a value for a period of time to give you power and control. And that's the problem with racial capitalism, where it's relationships, because a lot of people die very lonely because they don't have friends or family because, you know, of the harm that's been involved in those relationships. People move away and then people are very isolated and lonely. And so, you know, then we have those issues in our community. Sisters Inside, for me, was about, for all of us, it was about giving us a voice, because no one knew we were there, no one was listening to us, we didn't have a voice. And I think we've successfully done that. But the success has been turned where governments have taken the issue for criminalising and imprisoning women and girls, where they fund certain things but are now funding those organisations that never gave a shit about women and girls and still don't today, but they're only interested in the dollar and the building of NGO carceral empires, which is a problem because they're not there for the women, they're there for the state. They're an extension of the prison system. But, you know, back then too, it was about, for me, and it still is, Sisters Inside's about all women. Not all, it couldn't be not all women except for Storm, who murdered my friend, which actually meant then for me and that train of thinking is that I had to resolve the issue of Storm, right? So, you know, very early on the piece, you know, we got managed, and the other women in prison that are on the committee, they're like, are you fucking kidding me? You're going to invite her up here? Like, because everyone was affected, even those women that were still there, the lifers, they'd lived through it as well. And it was highly traumatic for everyone. No, we got nothing. All the prison officers could leave and take leave outside. We had to live in the same prison together and get on with it. And so we had to use basically transformative justice to be able to survive. And so, you know, how are we going to live together where we don't continue the harm where someone else is dead? Because prisons are very violent places and payback is one of the highest, it's the biggest, you know, the rule, the priority rule. If someone harms you or someone else, you got to harm them back. Even worse. But I mean, but anyway, they asked Storm to come up and Storm's like, who asked you? And they said, oh, Debbie. And so she's come up thinking, what the hell? Anyway, but over months and months, this is without screws, anybody, it's just us. We worked through. Anyway, long story short, so Storm became involved in Sisters Inside on the management committee and I advocated for her to get parole and she's been out now for over a decade and we're mates. You know, we worked through all that harm and come out the other side. And that's what you got to do. You got to do the healing, and the only way you can do the healing is by, well, I believe, confronting it. I think a lot of, you know, everyone's a victim of harm in one way or another. And I'm really not interested in the hierarchy of victimhood because that's what we see play out in victim groups. You know, I was harmed worse than you, so my voice is louder than yours. You need to shut up. Like, my child was killed, your house was robbed, so that means nothing. You know what I mean? Like, there's this hierarchy of victimhood which actually doesn't do any favours for anyone. And you've got to resolve it to move forward because only then can you see others to be able to support others and move forward. Otherwise, you know, me and Storm could end up killing her or vice versa. And it's like, that's not something that we wanted. So Sisters is about that for me. It's about more so now because, you know, Sisters started in 92, so it's like 32 years ago. More so now for me, it's about supporting young women, particularly young Aboriginal women in our organisation that have been working there for a long time and now they've that supported them being program managers. And, you know, eventually at the end of the day, they'll take over the organisation when I step back in whatever form that looks like. that's where Sisters Inside has to land, is in the hands of those young Aboriginal women to move it forward in the abolitionist framework, and in the hands of formerly incarcerated women. Right at this moment, at this point in history, lots of people are labelling themselves of lived experience, which I find problematic. I suppose in the last decade, it's like everyone's got to have a fucking label. What are you going to have a label for? Like, seriously. We fought for years and years ourselves to never have labels, right? We just wanted to be accepted in the community as we are as individuals. Now everyone's got a label. And I don't understand that. And that's because of being criminalised and imprisoned. And it's, you know, a new younger generation are labelling themselves in many ways and forms, which is important to them, and I respect that. I don't understand. I suppose I understand it's about challenging the status quo, but the lived experience is a problem because there's women and girls in cages now. So if you are formerly incarcerated and doing work out in the community and speaking out about the fundamental issues for women who are caged and girls, you have to be held accountable in what you're saying. So you need to have the connection, the relationship with women in the prison. So there's lots of, for example, people in the community that have been in prison that saying, I've lived experience, sitting on boards, sitting in academia, wherever, getting jobs, but not, they're not going in the prison and being held accountable by women in prison, and they're talking on behalf of women in prison. And that's not on, as far as I'm concerned. If, you know, the day that I'm not endorsed by the women inside on our steering committee and other women, the day I don't have relationships with inside is I won't be speaking out. I have that endorsement and permission to do so, and I ensure, and I'm held accountable. There's been times over the years where women will ring up and say, you need to tell Debbie she better get in the prison, there's some shit happening. And I'll go in there and there'll be something being said that I've supposedly said or done. And I sit down with the women, I go, well, tell me. And we work through it about what has or what hasn't happened. Where a lot of people with lived experience won't do that. They're just saying, I've got a lived experience so I have the permission to sit. But what happens that is the system then uses them and say, we've got someone with lived experience endorsing what we're saying. Well, we don't endorse it because it's carceral. And this is the problem. Because the only answer to the question in regards to the prison industrial complex is abolition. So, you know, that's why not only me and Sisters Inside, but the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women have been writing articles about, you know, we wrote one recently, A Line in the Sand. You say you got lived experience and you're a reformist, well, game's on. You know, not going to have it. We're really clear. Our values, you know, of the National Network, the Sisters Inside, are abolitionist, and that's what we fight for women in cages and girls. We are not there to get jobs for us as individuals. See, they're part of the racial capitalism. And, you know, and it's predominantly women that would really have nothing to say inside the prison. They would probably keep to themselves and have no relationship. You know, I remember one woman come out who, white middle class, and was in the low security and wanted to do a placement, had been doing a degree. And I said, sure, because I'm happy to do that because it opens doors for other women as well. Anyway, and one of the things that they said was, because, you know, it was about writing some policy stuff and submissions, and it was about, you know, the mass incarceration of Aboriginal women. And she said, I didn't even see any Aboriginal women. I said, well, you walk around with fucking blinkers on, seriously. Are you blind? But the thing is, she went to prison, gets inducted at the maximum security prison, and then gets sent to a low security prison. Yes, there's no or a few Aboriginal women there because of the racism in the system. They don't get classified low and don't get moved to a low security prison. But to say that, you know, and interested in their own individualism and how they're going to progress themselves, not really interested in the women at all. You know, and I think that's what's different when you've grown up in the prison system and so aware of it. You know, it's 50 years this year since I was first put in a prison, And I've been going either locked in prisons or been going in and out of prisons for the last 50 years of my life. So I respect and honour and I'm honoured to be able to continue to go back in the prison and sit with the women and, you know, and support them in what they need to do. And the women are actually speaking out of what they want. They have their own agency and they're doing their own advocacy about what they want. And what they don't want are these carceral organisations that the state funds, because the women know that they're not there for them. These organisations ring the cops and ring parole and get them locked up when they're out in the community, if they're not complying to conditions. You know, and that's one of the things Sisters I would never do is call the cops or call parole. We deal with the issues ourselves in that, you know, the relationship that we have. You know, we've been around, like I said, for 32 years. We've never called the cops once to come to our office or anywhere else, ever. Never, ever, ever, you know. Well, you know, when I first became a parent, I was just turned 17, literally, on the 12th of January, and Jodie was born on the 1st of February. So what's that, 2 weeks, 3 weeks maybe? I was a kid myself, thinking I was a big woman, right? You do when 17-year-olds, we think we're big adults. And when, you know, I sit here now and think, oh, my God, I see little young ones, you know, and sisters who are pregnant. I'm like, oh, my God, you know. I think people think that when you have a child, when you have a baby, you know what needs to happen. You don't know shit, like seriously. We don't. There's no rule book. There's nothing to tell us. And back then, you know, even less. So I would say that back then I was a mother, probably not a very good mother, because I didn't know what I was doing. I was so young and I was a kid. And that wasn't good for Jodie. And then what wasn't good for her as well is, like, the last time I went to prison, she was 11, and being an 11-year-old, her life was just tipped upside down, and my parenting wasn't the best parenting. It, you know, probably the best that I could do at the time with the information I had, with Josh, with others. He was the youngest, so he was 2, you know, when he was ripped off me. And still has abandonment issues. They all have abandonment issues, and all kids whose mums go to prison have abandonment issues, and that can manifest in many different ways. So that's the healing that they need to do about it. You know, and I used to say when I come home, if I was going somewhere, I'm going to come back. I'm not going to abandon you. I'd use the language because that was the core of the fear and the harm, you know. But I knew more then because I'd worked through the Debbie's murder, I was older, I can articulate things better. You know, it's all about, you know, getting older and having more experiences. But, I mean, you also got to develop relationships over the years. Like, you can't just stay stagnant because we all change who we are as humans, you know, because of not only internally but externally and what, you know, externals have come into our lives. And so the relationships have to keep being built and on and change and move. You know, I think when relationships maintain the same old, that's when they collapse. Instead of, you know, where for me it's about recognising I'm different in this way and you're different in that way. So how are we going to pull this together and, you know, for us to continue forward? It's like any relationship to be healthy, to have those conversations. And I would hope as you get older and get wiser, I think so. I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. Who would know? I want to imagine a world that, say, as of today, no, any baby born as from today on is never harmed. And imagine what the world would be like then. If there was no harm ever again from today on, or any child born, in 20 years' time, we would be in a very different world that we lived in. Like, imagine that. And so I know that we're doing a small bit with my grannies, but that's just the teeniest, tiniest dot in the whole wide world. But I always imagine, like, every baby born today, that not one of them are harmed ever, ever again. There's no harm in the world. The world would be such a different place. The world would be a place that I can't even get my head around, that to imagine what it would be like. Yeah.